Tell
I just agree with what you said, that the Civil War had its goals and it had there was actual uses for it.
Okay, so you think the war was good for something. All right, great. All right, Sakita says, okay, keep going.
Well, one of the things like we were watching yesterday, I mean, not yesterday, Tuesday, in the videos was who was it good for, like, in whose perspective, because, like, with the excerpt that we watched from, I don't remember the movie, but Denzel character, they weren't necessarily getting anything out of war. They were just, some of them were just loyalists going with, you know, these white captors, and others were like promised up to freedom that they might not have got. So that's more of my thing is like, well, was it good for us? Because more of it could have been good.
What's your position, sister? It's okay, either way. What's your position? Is Africans fighting in the Civil War? Was Africans fighting in the Civil War good for anything? And is it sometimes good to go to war? Safi, I'm talking to you.
Yeah, I'm not. I feel like it's a case to case basis.
Well, I asked you about the case. One case I said is a civil war. So that's case. So yes or no? What's your position?
Yeah, okay. I feel like it was beneficial.
Okay. That sounds like a resignation. You know, it's cool. It's your position. All right. Yeah, that movie is a piece of trash. Glory. I wish it was never made. It's a piece of trash. And then let me tell you why it's a piece of trash. I never would show it. And I'll talk to Baba Sean as we would analyze it. The reason that I would never show that movie, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's an actually great transition to what we're to this focus today. That movie, the essence of it was that we were fighting to show, or one of the messages, I don't mean the essence, one of the messages that I abhor is that we were fighting and motivated to show and to prove to white people that we were fighting men, that we deserve respect, that we would fight, etc. And it's a distortion. The distortion is we didn't need any white colonel to motivate us to fight for our freedom. We were already fighting for our freedom. We didn't need to prove anything to white people about our ability to fight in terms of a motivation for us to fight for our mamas and our sisters and our brothers and our wives. And part of that movie shows that. Good old Morgan Freeman, who's known for playing movies where black people are trying to earn respect from white folks, as talented as he is, and I respect his talent, and he's has a penchant for finding scripts that follow that line. But that's a piece that I categorically disagree with. And it doesn't follow the historical record. Now, one other thing that I got a problem with Glory, of the battles that we fought in the Civil War, black soldiers, African soldiers, overwhelmingly won most of them. I think we only lost about two or three. We were known as the fighting force that won the Civil War for the North and won our freedom for us. In fact, it was said that there's a book that I encourage you to buy. It's called Journey of the Songhai People. Journey of the Songhai People. S-O-N-G-H-A-Y is the way Baba spells it, and it's written by Ed Robinson, who's still living. He's 90 years old, actually probably 92. He lives in Philadelphia and is a friend of mine. That's it, Journey of the Songhai People. Now, just so that you know, Songhai correctly spelled is S-H-O-N-G-A-I. Don't worry about it. That's the Malian spelling. You'll get to it with what you have there. And in that, he does an excellent job on Africans in the Civil War. Excellent job. And it ought to be in all of your homes and all of your libraries and reading it as a family, and certainly passing it down from student to student is an excellent way to do that. So two things, just so that we stay focused here, is that I want you to take away is that Africans fought in many battles, and we won overwhelmingly most of them, only losing about two or three of the battles. Story is the Battle of New Market Heights. This is a story that you'll find in Journey of the Songhai People. Have you heard this? Has Baba Shan taught you this? The New Market Heights. I don't want to repeat it if you ever. All right. Well, I'm glad Allende is in there because it happened around his neck of the woods. The Confederates had all the first year of the war, the Confederates were winning. When did the Civil War, so-called Civil War, start? What you got? Help me tell the story. Does anybody know the dates of the Civil War? Let me back up so we can tell the story. Somebody else guessing? No, 1812. You're cold.
I was 1862.
1862. You're close, but not quite. I see 1861 in the text chat. You're absolutely right, Abdullah. What was the date in 61? Does anybody know? And this is why. Okay. All right. We'll get to it. Just put in a question mark the date. So the whole first year from 61 to 62. Okay. It was in the spring, just as a hint. From 61 to 62, the North was losing the war. And in fact, General Ben Butler, who was a white general and operating at that time in South Carolina, was later to tell Lincoln, you know, that we've lost every major battle. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. The Battle of New Market Heights, where Africans had come in to fight. Africans from the north, the video that y'all saw in that terrible movie, the group was the Fighting 54th, and they were a powerful fighting force. But they were late, actually, because Africans in the south had already formed themselves as regiments as a fighting force early on. And when the Africans, after quote-unquote Emancipation Proclamation, then the Africans from the North joined them. And one of the Confederates, the reason I said the North was losing is because the Confederates moved the Confederacy. I mean, they were so confident in their winning that they actually moved the capital of the Confederacy. Does anybody know where the first capital of the Confederacy was? What state? If you don't know, just say, no, I don't know. Put N in the text chat. Come on. Got we roll with it so I know. All right. It was in Montgomery, Alabama, the deep south. That's where the capital of the Confederacy was, Montgomery. Well, the south was so confident, they moved the capital of the Confederacy to where, Allende? Where was the capital of the Confederacy moved to? Ooh, anybody? There you go, Richmond. So the capital of the Confederacy is Richmond. Well, just so you know, how far is Richmond from Washington, D.C.? Long way, short way, 2 miles, 100 miles. How long does it take to get there? Yeah, like 90 miles. Okay, so literally, folks said, nah, we coming to your back door. We're going to move the Capitol Confederacy right next to the Capitol of the United States. And, in fact, had won significant battles in Maryland. And there was this place called New Market Heights. Because, you see, in order to take Richmond, you had to take New Market Heights. And there was this New Market Heights was called that because it was a hill. To take New Market Heights, you had to cross the creek. Well, when you tried to cross the creek, you were sitting duck to the sharpshooters and the cannons that would, you know, protect New Market Road. And so Grant, who was Grant? Who am I talking about when I say Grant? Anybody? Ulysses Grant. He was a general for the North, okay, at that time. So he tried some white divisions. And every time he tried to take New Market Road, New Market Heights, so that he could go on and push back the Confederates out of Richmond, he was rebuffed. They were slaughtered. They were torn up. And after two attempts with his best white troops, he said, send in the colored troops. And that's what they called them. Send for the Africans. Now, when we arrived, responding from different regiments, we surveyed the situation, and it didn't look good. We knew that there was going to be some serious casualties, that this was not going to be easy by any stretch of the imagination, and many of us wouldn't make it home. And so the brothers started something saying, remember Fort Pillow. Remember Fort Pillow. Now, Fort Pillow is immortalized in a poem by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And what happened there is one of the forts that was manned by a garrison of black soldiers. And those soldiers had gone out on a mission and left the fort with just a small company of men to, you know, defend it. And when they were gone, the Confederate soldiers happened on this fort that was basically unsecured. And so the black women and elders and children, you know, quickly surrendered because there was no way that small garrison could defeat that particular army. And so they surrendered. And Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, for whom number of schools, Forrest schools, named in the South, Forrest Avenue, Forrest whatever, a name for Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, who became the founder of the Ku Klux Klan at that later on. He was in charge of the white regiment from the Confederates. And he took the surrender and killed every man, woman, and child. And when we were on the ground, our ancestors, our mamas and babies and whatever, he made them run the bayonets through our skulls. And so these brothers on the precipice of this great fight at New Market Heights that was necessary to beat the Confederates back, they said, remember Fort Pillow. They didn't say, remember that we're trying to prove ourselves to these white folks. Remember, we're trying to prove our manhood. They didn't say, remember, that the white people are trusting and believing in us. They said, remember Fort Pillow. Remember our ancestors. And remember what they did, how they killed our women and children mercilessly. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, they hit the water, crossing over this creek. And as soon as they began, the night lit up with fires from the sharpshooters, from the guns of the Confederates, raining down on them. As dawn broke, the water had turned red with our blood. We kept on going. The brother who was holding the flag was shot, okay, and another brother picked it up. We charged up this hill where we were just being mowed down. But somehow, one of the brothers got to the sharpshooter on the left, took him out. Got to the sharpshooter on the right, took him out. And we took, with massive loss of life, we took New Market Heights. Marched on and took Fort Harrison that same day. And this was toward the end of the war. And a little bit later, we fought this Confederate troops back in to the Appomattox Courthouse. And we held them there until General Grant could get there. And while his story will tell you that General Lee surrendered to General Grant, it was your ancestors that defeated General Lee and held them up until General Grant could get there. That's the Battle of the New Market Heights, and you'll find that in the Library of Congress, my brothers and sisters. You'll find the story of Fleetwood. His name is Christian Fleetwood. I'm telling you that story from his diary. A year before he started that battle, he had been in the war and had gone home. After his year's service, he went to, I think it was Boston. And after staying for a little while, he told his wife, "I got to go back." And she said, "Why you got to go? It's like you've already, you know, fought. And, you know, they're going to treat us like they treated us after the Revolutionary War. You know, they're going, you know, they're not going to respect what you've done." He said, "I'm not free, and we're not free until all of us are free." He said, "I got to go back." And then he went back, and he led that charge at Battle at New Market Heights. That is an example of our fighting, okay, in the Civil War. Let me stop there. Questions, comments, because I got several other ones for you. Okay, questions, comments. Hopefully, type in the text chat Christian Fleetwood. In fact, let's do 60 seconds. I want 60 seconds. Find everything you can find out about Christian Fleetwood on the internet right now. Christian Fleetwood. See what you can find. Allende, see what you can find about the Battle of New Market Heights and where is it in relationship to you. It'd be a good field trip for you. All right, so you got something that you can follow up with, and I'm asking you to do that because I want you to be able to follow up with this. It's not enough for you to know generally that we fought in the Civil War. I want you to be able to call the names. I want you to be able to call the battle, not of every battle, but simply of at least one or two stories. You got to have some specificity with it in order for you to really appreciate who our ancestors were and what we did and how we were warriors. All right. Ready for story number two? Any questions before I go? Any questions? Any comments? Had you heard this before? How do you feel as a result of hearing that story before I go to the next one? Blase, doesn't matter. What is it good for? Talk to me. You're gonna see my light on just because I'm going at it, but you still talk to me in addition to type.
No, I don't have any questions.
How do you feel about it, Abdullah? How do you feel about that story I just told you?
I don't feel any particular way. I mean, this information, so.
Okay, you got three feelings. You got six feelings, son. Anytime you have anything, anytime we are doing anything, learning anything, there's mad, sad, scared, joyful, peaceful, and powerful. And they are with us all the time. That we aren't aware of them is part of the healing work that we have to do. And, of course, there's different intensity. I can be really mad or just a little bit. I can be really scared or a little bit. I can be really joyful or just a little bit. You know, I can be really peaceful or just a little bit. What's important is that we become emotionally literate and know how to read our feelings, even when they just are real fine. Like, you know, not just when somebody has a gun to my head or I'm in some imminent danger, but just a little danger or a little joy. So of mad, sad, scared, joy, peace, and power. Tell me which one of them, upon hearing that story, do you feel? Abdul.
Abdul. Peaceful.
Peaceful. All right. A little peaceful. Okay, great. Anybody else? How you feel learning that story about your ancestors fighting for your freedom? Peaceful. Powerful. Okay. Mm-hmm. Peaceful. That's interesting. That's interesting. No joyful? You're not happy that your ancestors fought for your freedom? Okay, no powerful? No powerful at all, huh? I tell you. Well, the first time Mama Fear heard that story, we were working. We owned a neighborhood grocery store, and there was a game way back in the day called Galaga. And this was basically a game where, you know, these were these big video machines in the stores where you stand up, you put a quarter in, and that's people would come in during the day. And so she went over to those machines, an arcade game. After hearing that story, and she started playing, and she played the best, because this game, you gotta fight, you gotta fire and whatever. She said she would tell people for months about the effect on her and her playing this game as a result of being filled with pride, knowing that these brothers put their life on the line and gave life for her to be free. She said she was so inspired by their work and by their success and by what they did, what they gave, that she felt joyful. She felt powerful. And that power manifested itself in her scoring the highest that she's ever scored on that, before or since. So just, encourage you to just have that part of that story. All right. Let's go to another story so you get to appreciate your ancestors. Let's go to the Knights of Tarba. You see, before the Civil War, you have already studied what black people were doing for our freedom. Have you not? Tell me a couple of things. What is your sense from your research of the temperament of black people before the Civil War, the so-called Civil War started? What was our temperament about captivity? What have you learned? Did we like it? Did we accept it? Was it a good thing? Did we surrender? Do we say, well, that's just how Lord made it, and Lord, arranged it to be, and Lord made us Africans in captivity, and so I guess that's what the Lord wanted us to be. Talk to me, folks.
There was a constant revolt and rebellion.
Constant revolt and rebellion. Absolutely. Does everybody confirm that? We rebelled. Okay, we resisted. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Mad, sad, scared, joyful, peaceful, and or powerful. You can feel more than one. Talk to me. Typing is good while somebody else is talking. If nobody's on the mic, hit it.
Powerful and joyful.
Powerful and joyful. Okay. Well, you're on the money. And there is a group called the Knights of Tarba. And they had been secretly training. And and secretly stashing guns in fields, and stashing bullets in fields, and they were under the tutelage of a general. His name escapes me right now, but it'll come up. And they met in Tennessee to and they came from seven southern states, and they were planning their attack. And the instructions were, when they started, for them to kill every white man, woman, child they could, and take the ammunition, and meet in Atlanta, Georgia. They were serious. They'd been planning for years. They were a secret society. They'd been amassing guns and ammunition. They were the Knights of Talbot. And when they met on the eve of their getting ready to fight, the general said, "Hold up." He said, I see something. I see that these folks are beginning, are likely to start fighting among themselves. So what we want to do is chill for right now and stay ready. So when they start fighting among themselves, then we'll break. Does that make good sense to you? Is that a good strategy? Talk to me, y'all. Talk to me. The mic is open. Type when nothing's there. All right? So that's what they did. They chilled. But they chilled in a sense of readiness. And so when many of the Union soldiers got to different areas in the South, black people had already taken over the town. In fact, many there were times where the Union soldiers actually put black people back into captivity because the Union soldiers were not fighting for our freedom, were they?
No.
Thank you. No, they weren't fighting for our freedom. We were fighting for our freedom. Okay, they were fighting for big business, which is what white folks almost always fight for. And so, because we had already prepared ourselves, because we were already prepared to fight, we were able to free ourselves in many of the southern states. This is long before the Fighting 54 came up. And one of the areas where you had these fighting groups was in South Carolina. And you had these white colonels and stuff fighting. And another, well, one of them, his name is Ben Butler. And basically, the white soldiers started deserting. The white soldiers were mostly immigrants, as in everybody, every white person to America were basically immigrants. Y'all got that, right? And what year are we talking about?
1861.
61, 62. And when was the United States kind of codified as the United States? When did America as a country start?
It was in 17... I think it was like 1721.
Was 1783? Mm-hmm. Nima says 1783. Count of what do y'all say? Come on now. Don't leave the sister out there hanging. I'm glad she's jumping in. When was the country? Now, I'm only saying this so you get a perspective. I'm telling you this is happening in 61, you know, and most of the people, white fighters, were immigrants. Give me some context in the timeline. When did this country become the United States as we know it? Or not as we know it now, but as we know it having come into existence as opposed to being a British colony. What you got?
Wasn't it 1776?
Mm-hmm. 60 seconds. Hit it, folks. 60 seconds. 30 seconds. Find out. Go, everybody. Don't be waiting on nobody else to find out for you. When was America formed? And When was the United States codified? July 4, 1776. What did you find out about July 4, 1776? Well, we'll get deep into that later. The July 4th was signing of the Declaration of Independence. And so you're close, because that's what most people kind of think. The Declaration of Independence was when the country was codified, but not quite. You're an Higher Education Institute student. You don't just go along with hype. Declaration of Independence, for example, you can declare today, you want to declare that you're independent of your family. But that may not be the same date that you actually become a free person, because you got to get past your mom and your dad and the courts. All right. So the all right. So you're coming. So you know what the 1776, and actually, to be actual honest, it was not even July 4th. But that's something they don't tell you in your the history books. The truth is what they don't tell you, because they're so busy promoting the myth. And let me just digress there. For those of you, when I'm telling you these stories, who, you know, you don't kind of know what you feel, the role of myth is to propel. Myth has a powerful psychological role, okay? And so, folks, we'll continue with the July 4, 1776 mythology. Even though folks know that that's not the actual date of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, for that matter, and it's also definitely not the founding of the United States of America. At the same time, it serves as a point, as if when you declare you're independent, then you're in fact free, and that's what it did. It's a kind of power move, and it serves to empower Americans, although it's mythology. And mythology has that purpose to empower. And so whenever you're hearing stories about yourself and your people that are empowering, they tend to do the same thing over time. All right, let's get back with it. I said 1862, 63. So we're less than 100 years of when the United States was formed as the United States. So you have a lot of immigrants here, and immigrants coming. Most people who had just come here, in terms of their generations, if you think about less than 100 years. And so these white soldiers who were immigrants, many of them, and were conscripted to war. What does conscripted mean? Guess if you don't know.
Inclined to?
Inclined is a good guess. Anybody else? Come on, Kanata. Come on, Sakila. Come on, Savia. Conscripted. They were conscripted.
Drafted?
Very good. Very good. Very good. You had to fight. And so they went to fight. But I just told you that, and I just told you that they lost every major battle the first year. So what do you think these soldiers did? They deserted. Many of them split. They said, "No, we ain't signed up for this." And many of them split. So Ben Butler was down in South Carolina trying to fight. And he had these immigrants who were only half-hearted soldiers, because they weren't fighting for any real homeland, because they had just arrived, either themselves or just a generation or two before. So they weren't fighting for any real homeland. They certainly weren't motivated to fight for our freedom. And they were facing Confederate soldiers who were fighting for an ideal, okay, that is white supremacy, who didn't do nothing but shoot rabbits anyway. And so this is what Ben Butler was facing. And so he, in fact, began to use those Knights of Taba, those African soldiers who had already prepared themselves to fight. And he formed them in a fighting force. This was long before the Massachusetts 54. This was before the Emancipation Proclamation. This is when he was fighting Ben Butler, the white general there, and needed some help. And African troops were that help. fighting for our freedom. So much so that Ben Butler went to Lincoln in the summer after the first year of the war, and it started in April. And after that first year in the summer, Ben Butler went to Lincoln, and he sat in the office with President Lincoln and Secretary Seward, S-E-W-A-R-D. And he said, I'm going to paraphrase if you don't mind, but this is in the Library of Congress if you want to have the stilted language. But he said, Prez, I don't know where you've been. I don't know what you've been doing. Maybe you've been hiding under a rock, but I'm here to tell you, as somebody in the field, that the North has lost every major battle this first year. And there stands in waiting a black force waiting to rush on stage to save us. Excuse me, Secretary Seward was uncomfortable with that terminology, that black people would be called in to save the Union. And so he said, excuse me, Ben, you know, what do you mean? And Ben Butler repeated the same thing. That is, that these black troops are waiting. There's this black force. We can use them to win. They can save us because we're getting our butts beat. And Secretary Seward then huddled with Lincoln and said, I tell you what, the world, now this is a quote, the world would make much of the fact, Ben, that we white folks had to extend our hand to black folks to save us. So tell you what you got to do. I want you to go out and win for us one major battle. And if you do that, then you'll have your black help. Now, so the next major battle was the Battle of Antietam. The Battle of Antietam. 10,000 Confederate soldiers, 10,000 were killed. 12,000 Union soldiers were killed. Seward said, well, that's good enough. And then Lincoln signed in September the Emancipation Proclamation as a fit and necessary war measure so that black troops fighting for our freedom could also help save the Union. He made it effective, however, January 1st. So he told his Union, his Confederate folks, I'm going to issue a Emancipation Proclamation freeing black people. Now, was this a general? Were all black people freed by Emancipation Proclamation? That was happening in September 1862. What do you know about that? Do you know anything about it? Have you covered it yet?
The Emancipation Proclamation itself?
Yeah, did the writing of the Emancipation Proclamation, did the words of it, did the signing of it, did that free African people who were in bondage?
No, because even during the Civil War, after the black people were allowed to fight in the Union side, people's families were still in captivity, and that's one of the reasons why they were fighting.
Yeah, they certainly were fighting. So, okay, so that folks were still in captivity. In the language of it, just so that you know, and we don't have time to go into it as much as we will next year because it's about time for us to do the Araminta course where you'll get some more of this in more depth. It's called Following Araminta. But here, what you can know about this Emancipation Proclamation is it said, and I hope y'all are taking some notes, it said that the black people who were in states of rebellion were declared free as a fit and necessary war measure, which means if you were African in captivity and you had not joined the Confederacy of states seceding from the Union, then you just out of luck because it didn't apply to you. So I want you to understand that this quote-unquote Emancipation Proclamation only sought, and I say sought, to free black people so that we could be used as fighting instruments in the Union cause. Not because there were any kind of moral anything, love of black people, captivity is bad, or anything. And, as Nima is saying, how is Lincoln going to free black people in areas that no longer are under his jurisdiction, that is no longer recognized his presidency and his authority? It would be like me telling you that you are free in your mama's house, that you have, I am signing a proclamation saying, Allende, you are hereby free of the rule of your mom and dad. You think that would work, Allende?
No.
You mean you could wave that in front of them and say, Bible Kessler said, I'm free and I don't have to follow your rules anymore. What would happen to you? What would happen?
I don't know exactly what would happen, but they would treat that like a joke. That wouldn't really, authorize anything.
Bingo! So the Confederate folks say it's a joke. And the Union folks, you know, so what it did is in 3 months after that, from September, he signed it September, so November, October, November, December, at the end of December, Emancipation Proclamation, so-called, took effect. Now, what it did do is the Africans in the northern states began to organize regiments. And Frederick Douglass began to organize the 54th, and others organized black people who had run away from captivity and who were enjoying some modicum of freedom in the north to go and fight. And I'm already telling you there were already Africans who were fighting in the south. And I just want to get you the picture right so you don't see these northern troops, black or white, just came down to free these black people. Black people already were prepared to fight, waited until there was a break, a split, and then also accelerated the fighting, which is why Ben Butler could use African troops there. Now, I want you to also remember that conversation between Lincoln and Seward, okay? Now, that leads me to another book that I want you to have in your family library. That this is a recommendation to you. Make sure you tell your parents if your parents are not in the room right now. And the book is W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction in America. We're going to be using it next year. And it's just a good family book to go through. All right, so I'm going to read just a little bit from this, from his chapter 4 on that. Let me just check. Y'all still with me?
Yes.
You're bored out of your mind? You can be honest. If you do, I'll try to do something else to make it more exciting to you. Are you learning some things you didn't know? All right. I want to give you a picture of this whole piece, so you don't want to get it piecemeal. All right. So let me just, before I get into this, give me somebody come on or type. What have you learned so far? What have you learned so far? You didn't know or didn't know as well. Talk and type.
I didn't know about the Battle of the New Market Heights or the Knights of Tarbes.
Anybody else? What you learned you didn't know?
I didn't know that the Union weren't even fighting for some degree of freedom for the African captives. I didn't know that before.
All right. Anybody else? Come on, y'all. Keep it coming. Everybody got something. Let's go. Didn't know about Seward. That should be Seward. Seward. Okay. Fleetwood is right. Okay. Well, I'm not talking about black Confederates, Safia. I'm only talking about what you learned today. I'm not talking about black Confederates. I rarely talk about black Confederates. They aren't worth talking about very much at all, only as a small footnote. So I'm asking you, what did you get from today
I didn't mean to type back Confederates. I meant the story of Christian Fleetwood. That's what I typed in first, and then I just accidentally made the connection to him being a black Confederate when he is one. So that's
okay. So you're clear that he was not in the Confederacy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So those black folks from the Knights of Tampa, they were not joining any Knights of any of that. Okay. Now, Du Bois, page 55. Y'all type in the text chat, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. So you know what to go and get. All right. The author is W period E period B period Du Bois, D U B O I S. Come on with it. All right. The introduction to chapter 4. How the Civil War meant emancipation, and how the black worker won the war by a general strike, which transferred his labor from the Confederate planter to the Northern invader, in whose army lines workers began to be organized as a new labor force. So that's just introduction. So from that introductory sentence, what is this chapter 4 going to be about? In your own words.
I'm not really sure. Would it be something about the labor force?
Very good. You're very warm. Certainly it's about the labor force. Come on, y'all. What do you think? What do you make of it? You just heard it for the first time, but you had some response. You heard some words. Allende, talk to me. All right, now.
Bubble, okay, could you repeat the question? I'm not sure I understand it.
The question is, I just read you an introductory sentence, okay? It's a set off. It's the introduction to the chapter. Just like your introductory paragraphs and your introduction to your chapters should give the reader a sense of what it's going to be about before you go into detail explaining it and showing it, he just gave us a sense of what this chapter is going to be about. We may want to skip over and come back to it, you know, or anything like that. So, because you don't have to read a book cover to cover, page to page, if you don't want to. So, he gave us this paragraph. I just read it. And what do you think it's going to be about? And now, from that sentence, Nima said it's going to be about labor. That's right. What else is it going to be about?
I think it may be about the African labor force, or it might be like Africans work in the military, not maybe as soldiers, but as maintenance.
All right. Good. Good. Excellent. You and Nima on the point on that. One more key part of this from that introduction. I'm going to read it again. This chapter, called The General Strikes, Chapter 4, How the Civil War Meant Emancipation, and How the Black Worker Won the War by a General Strike, which transferred his labor from the Confederate planter to the Northern invader, in whose army lines workers began to be organized as a new labor force. So what else did you hear, in addition to what you've heard already from Nima and Sakila? Nothing else? Come on, folks.
I have another idea, though. I think it shows a transition. Like, it shows more like just being transferred from one captor to another captor, like you didn't really achieve anything.
Nope. But good guess. You keyed on the word transfer. That's excellent. One of the things when you're listening to anything, follow the verbs. Make sure you zone in on the verbs. The verbs are the action words. If you follow the verbs, you'll follow the action, and you can put the actors in. You may have to go back and whatever, but you know what the action is, or you know what the condition, the state of being is. Okay? What were the verbs? You remember any verbs? Transferred was one. Good. Any other verb? Who does the author, W.E.B. Du Bois, eminent black scholar, claim won the war? I'll read it again. Chapter 4, The General Strike. How the Civil War meant emancipation, and how the black worker won the war. How? By a general strike that transferred his labor from the Confederate planter to the Northern invader.
Oh, okay. If you're saying that the black workers won the Civil War because of their strike against working.
Indeed. Indeed. Now, this is the part where often we miss. We miss what win wars, okay? We think the war is only won on the actual battlefield. That is, when one warrior is clashing bam, boom, with another. Well, that makes good Hollywood. But let's say that you're at war with an enemy, and your folks are out there, and you're a part of a regiment that's out there, and you're in the field. And this is a long, you know, protracted war. You're in the field for 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. Where are you getting your food from?
The black workers that planted.
You're getting food from back home. Wherever your particular is, you got to have somebody providing the food. Where are you getting your medicine from? Where are you getting your clothes from? Who's making the clothes? God, I mean, your shoes wear out, don't they? So you got to have some new shoes. You got to have some food to keep going. Are you going to be a good warrior when you're just having to, you know, scavenge for, go around there and hunt rabbits while you're supposed to be shooting? That wouldn't be a good idea because you let people know where you are. So you're not going to be a good worker, I mean, a good soldier starving. In any war, your war has to be supported. Literally, the machine to support the war is much, much greater than the actual battle. Okay? Even now, if you're going to fight a battle, you know, I mean, do you know what it costs for an F-15 fighter jet? Do you know how much time it takes to make it? Okay, but my point is, the Africans who were in captivity, in bondage in the South, said, we are not going to feed, clothe, support, build bridges for, build wheels for wagons, build guns for these folks who are keeping us in bondage. In fact, we're going to split. So we're not only going to strike and says we refuse to plant potatoes and harvest potatoes and corn and all of that. We're not only going to strike, we are then going to actually transfer. We are going to the northern lines whenever we can. And we didn't just go there for protection. We went there to give our labor to support that force so that that invading force could win. Are y'all with me on that? Do you understand that? Do you understand that, Safia? Do you understand that, y'all? Do you understand how powerful a role it is? All right, I'm going to read a little bit more. Is that all right? If I read a little bit more of this from W.B.? All right, come on. When Edwin Ruffin, white-haired and mad, fired the first gun at Fort Sumter, that's S-U-M-T-E-R, Fort Sumter, this was the white man, Edward Ruffin, white-haired and mad, fired the first gun at Fort Sumter. He freed the Africans. It was the last thing he meant to do, but that was because he was so typically a Southern oligarch. What's oligarch? What's an oligarch? If you don't know, look it up right quick. Try and keep the story going. What's oligarch? He was so typical, spelled O-L-I-G-A. Oligarchy.
I know what that is. That's when, I know what oligarchy is.
Okay.
That's when the government is ruled by, like, only a few people or just one person.
Good. Kind of, you're warm. Check it out. What you got? Check it out. What is oligarch or oligarchy?
Oligarchy.
There.
Okay. Oligarch is like a power structure where there's only a few people on top, and they're usually distinguished by royalty or wealth. And I know, I think that's how it's like a modified version that they have over there in the UK or England or something like that.
Nah, not even close. They have a veneer like with the queen and stuff like that, but they don't really have no power. But we'll get, that's a time for another story. All right, so Sakila's on time, Abdullah's on time, so let me keep reading, okay? It was the last thing he meant to do, but that was because he was so typically a southern oligarch. He didn't know the real world about him. He was provincial and lived apart on his plantation with his servants, his books, and his thoughts. Outside of agriculture, he jumped at conclusions instead of testing them out by careful research. He knew, for instance, that the North would not fight. He knew that Africans would never revolt. And so war came. War was murder, force, anarchy, and debt. Y'all, war is debt, as well as the other things, okay? Make sure you remember that. Its end is evil, despite all incident good. Neither North nor South had before 1861 the slightest intention to go to war. The thought, in many respects, was ridiculous. They were not prepared for war. The national army was small. That is, the United States Army was small. It was poorly equipped and without experience. There was no file from which someone might draw plans of subjugation. When Northern armies entered the South, they became armies of emancipation. It was the last thing they planned to be. The North did not propose to attack property. It did not propose to free Africans. This was to be a white man's war to preserve the Union, and the Union must be preserved. Nothing that concerned the amelioration of the African touched the heart of the mass of Americans, nor could the common run of men realize the political and economic costs of African captivity. When, therefore, the Southern radicals, backed by a political oligarchy, right, the Southern radicals, backed by this small group of folks who really were in charge, regardless of what it was called, economic dictatorship. Okay, so he's giving you some stuff here. You actually in the South had a political oligarchy. He had an economic dictatorship. What's a dictatorship?
A dictatorship is one person is telling a bunch of people what to do. It's like a one-person government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in your vocabulary, you know, we got oligarch and oligarchy, and we got dictatorship. You might as well throw amelioration in there as well. Amelioration. One more time. Amelioration. Amelioration. We're going to keep on going. So when therefore the Southern radicals, backed by political oligarchy and economic dictatorship in the most extreme form in which the world had seen it for 500 years, precipitated secession. That part of the North that opposed the plan had to hunt for a rallying slogan to unite the majority in the North and in the West, and if possible, bring the border states into the fight. Okay, so again, the North... When the Confederate states succeeded from the Union. And what does succeed mean when it says they succeeded from the Union?
They resigned or stepped away from or quit.
That's right, Kanata. You ain't hitting the button today, brother. Are you with us?
Yes.
All right, well, you got to jump on some stuff. Guess sometimes, you know. So, yes, you're right, Nima, to resign, to leave. All right, freedom for Africans furnished no slogan. That is, the North had to come up whenever you're having a war and you're having to organize the people so the people will fight for it and support it and give their taxes to it and all the stuff like that. You got to come up with them. Like weapons of mass destruction, okay, was a slogan, right? Y'all remember that? I know y'all were kind of young when Iraq was invaded. But weapons of mass destruction, that was the slogan. We're looking for weapons of mass destruction. Of course, there were no weapons of mass destruction. But the point here is they needed a slogan, okay? And freedom for Africans was not that slogan, okay? Not one-tenth of the northern white population would have fought for any such purpose. Free soil was a much stronger motive, but it had no importance in this contest because free soilers, these were people who were fighting for the new states to come in as free. That is, as the United States was taking over new territory and a new territory was coming in, the question had to be, was that new state going to come in, Nebraska at the time, was that state was going to come in as a free state, that is, where there was no captivity allowed of African people? Or was it going to come in as a captive state where folks could have Africans in captivity? The group that was fighting against that were called free soilers, like the soil, S-O-I-L, all right? And just a little piece, why would white people, some of them in the North and West, want a state to come in where there's no African captivity? Why would that be desirable to white people, some white people? Any guesses? Any thoughts?
Maybe so that Africans would be able to, or be allowed to, fight for them if they ever had any other wars, you know, they would already be allowed to fight for them?
Good guess. Nah, that ain't it, but good guess, you know. I don't think they were thinking that far, and that's an excellent guess. Somebody else, guess. Just let your mind go. Abdullah, why do you think these white folks, free soilers, would want to fight for, to actually go to battle sometime, to have people, the state come in as a state that prohibited Africans being in captivity?
Because maybe more Africans would go over to that state, and that would, they weren't even thinking about their freedom. Maybe they're just thinking business-wise.
You're on the money. Think labor. You see, wherever you had Africans being allowed, white people being allowed to have Africans in captivity, think about it. Suppose you had to compete in the labor force right now. You getting ready to graduate. Y'all see your future. Or even during the summer, you're looking for jobs. And you got people who are able to have folks to work for nothing. How much are they going to pay you? Hello? How much are they going to pay you? Very little. And so this was a economic piece on the part of workers. Workers says, no, we don't want people to come in here and be able to have Africans in captivity because it drives down the wages. Okay? And in effect, has everybody almost be in captivity, even the white laborers. Okay? So those were the free soilers, just so that you know. What kind of time I got here? All right. We're doing okay. So now y'all, I know y'all typed free soilers in the text chat, right? I know you did. As much as I'm talking about free soilers, I know you just typed that in the text chat. Because I'm trying to make this as exciting and trying to tell you the story and put a lot in here. But I gotta have that you on it. You know that you, and you don't have to wait for me to tell you when to put something in the text chat. If you think something's important, if you've not heard of it before, and it's something that you may want to find more about, research about, come on. This is our story. Okay. So W. Du Bois saying free soilers, you know, wasn't a good slogan. Okay. On the other hand, the tremendous economic ideal of keeping this great market for goods, the United States, together with all its possibilities of agriculture, manufacture, trade, and profit, appealed to both the West and the North. And what was then much more significant, appealed to the border states. So here was this slogan. And I'm quoting, this is a quote from him, page 56. To the flag we are pledged, all its foes we abhor, and we ain't for the nigger, but we are for the war. Y'all got that?
Yes.
I just want you to understand, so when people start telling you what the North fought for and all of that, then you got a sense for it. You have a historical record, and none's better than this piece by Du Bois. The border states wanted the cotton belt in the Union so that they could sell it their surplus Africans. They also wanted to be in the same Union with the North and the West, where the profit of trade was large and increasing. The duty then of saving the Union became the great rallying cry of the war, for which for a long time the border states hesitate and confine secession to the far South. And yet they all knew that the only thing that really threatened the North, the Union, was African captivity, and the only remedy was abolition. So Abdullah was on the money. This was about business. It's the free soilers were about business in terms of wages. And the border states, okay, were also, and their support was about business. Now I'm going to jump over a bit. Over to page 57. Thus, the African himself was not seriously considered by the majority of men, North or South. And yet, from the very beginning, the African occupied the center of the stage. Now, when I say African, he's saying Negro, okay? Sometimes he says slaves, but you know we don't repeat that here, okay? He occupied the center of the stage because of the very simple physical reason. The war was in the South, and in the South, and I want you to type this down, there were 3,953,740 black Africans in captivity. 3,953,740 black Africans in captivity. Excuse me, more Nemas in this class? Savia? Come on, thank you. Y'all fired up. Come on. Keep it going. Now, and 261,918 free Africans. 261,918 free Africans. Now, what was to be the relation of this mass of workers to the war? What did the war mean to Africans? And what did the Africans mean to the war? There were two theories, both rather over elaborated. The one that the African did nothing but faithfully serve his captor until emancipation was thrust upon him. And the other, that the Negro, or excuse me, the African, immediately, just as quickly as the presence of the Northern soldiers made it possible, left serfdom and took his stand with the Army of Freedom. It must be borne in mind that 9/10 of the 4 million black Africans could neither read nor write, and that the overwhelming majority of them were isolated on country plantations. Okay, so now he's giving you the picture of it so that you can be back there and see what the deal was. Okay, that number that you typed in, 3,953,000, he's rounding off because that's close to 4 million. So 4 million Africans could neither read nor write and were isolated, weren't in cities. They were in isolated country plantations. Any mass movement under such circumstances must materialize slowly and painfully. Why is that? Why do you think he makes that claim? What he means is, it must. I'll repeat what he just said, and you tell me why you think he's making that claim. All right? He's giving you two facts. Of the 4 million black Africans, 9/10 of that 4 million could neither read nor write. And an overwhelming majority of them were in isolated country plantations. So to organize any mass movement under such circumstances must materialize, that is, come to be, you know, slowly and painfully.
Maybe he meant that it would be hard for all of them to make a mass movement because they were so spread out or that there were so many.
Okay, that's a good theory. Well, who agrees with Nima, or who has your own theory? What do you got?
Could you read the statement again?
Okay. It must be borne in mind that 9/10 of the 4 million Africans in captivity could neither read nor write, and that the overwhelming majority of them were isolated on country plantations. Any mass movement under such circumstances must materialize slowly and painfully.
So I think, one, I agree with Nima, and I also think they would have had to materialize slowly because there was a barrier breaking their communication. So one, they were like far away. They were in the countryside away from other plantations. And two, there was a lack of communication because they didn't have the ability to like read and write.
Very good. Excellent. Excellent. What the African did, according to Du Bois, was to wait, look and listen, and try to see where his interest lay. There was no use in seeking refuge in an army which was not an army of freedom. And there was no sense in revolting against armed captors who were conquering the world. As soon, however, as it became clear that the Union armies would not or could not return Africans, fugitive Africans, and that the captors, with all their fume and fury, were uncertain of victory, the Africans captive entered upon a general strike against captivity by the same methods that he used during the period of the fugitive captive. He ran away to the first place of safety and offered his services to the federal army, so that in this way it was really true that he served the former captors and served the Emancipation Army. And it was also true that this withdrawal and bestowal of his labor decided the war. So you get the picture. After checking out, because as Nima and Safia said, communication is going to be slow because you're going to have it be word of mouth. Somebody got to get to that plantation. Somebody got to tell the story. Somebody got to know what's happening. Okay? So they had to, you know, see what was going on. And then after deciding, because do y'all get the part of like, they're not going to be running to no Union Army if that Union Army was just going to put them back in captivity. So they had to check that out. Then they had also, if the South was going to win, there's no use running to the other side. You know, when the folks that you're, their captors are going to win the war, that'd make it even worse. And so they had to check it out. And that's what they did. And when they decided, then they moved to the Union armies and they transferred their services there. Let me continue quickly. The South counted on Africans as laborers to raise food. Now, when I say these, I want y'all to type them. They counted on Africans as laborers to do what? Raise food and money, crops, for civilians and for the army. To raise food and money, crops. That's what we were counted on for. Now, you got why we would raise food. Why would we be counted on to raise money, crops? Why would that be important in a war? What are money crops?
Crops that can sell for a really high price.
Very good. And if the South stopped producing money crops, then they wouldn't have anything to sell. And if they didn't have anything to sell, then what would be the result of that?
They would have economic failure.
Right, they don't have no money. And so you got to have money to make ships. You have money to make bullets. You got to have money to have guns. You got to have money to have uniforms. You got to have money to have hats, to have ceremonies, etc., to build bridges. You got to have money. And so the things that we were counted on to do, we said, no. So even in a crisis, to be used for military purposes, African revolt was an ever-present risk, but there was no reason to think that a short war with the North would greatly increase this danger. Publicly, the South repudiated the thought of its Africans even wanting to be rescued. The New Orleans Crescent showed the absurdity, this is a quote, the absurdity of the assertion that a general stampede of our Africans. The London Dispatch was convinced that Africans did not want to be free. Quote, as for the Africans themselves, crushed with the wrongs of Dred Scott and Uncle Tom, most provoking, they cannot be brought to burn with revenge. They are spies for their captors. This is what the London Dispatch is saying, and I've already taught you before that the South got a lot of its money from London, and you already know from the economic conundrum that the London and European investors, which backed the bank in the North, is why the North wouldn't give Lincoln money to fight. So, early in the war, the South had made careful calculation of the military value of Africans. Okay, it's 1019. The Alabama Advertiser in 1861 discussed the Africans as a military element in the South. This was the title of its article, The Military Element in the South, that is, Africans as a military element. It said, quote, the total white population in the 11 states now comprising the Confederacy is 5 million. And therefore, to fill up the ranks of the proposed army, 600,000, about 10% of the entire population, will be required. Now, I want to stop right now so you put some numbers in this so you know what this fight, what it looks like. Because if you don't have a sense for this fight, then it's just a mythical thing for you. So this is 1861. How many states were comprising the Confederacy in 1861, according to this article in the Alabama Advertiser, from what you just heard me say? Is anybody home?
I'm thinking.
I'm going to read the statement again, folks. It's from the Alabama Advertiser. Now, I've said that three times, so you really ought to have typed it in the text chat. You ought to by now kind of know some of the cues, okay? All right? The Alabama Advertiser in 1861. The article is a military element in the South. And it said, quote, the total white population of the 11 states now comprising the Confederacy. How many states, please? Okay, now, folks, you got to have to really, I'm doing this because I also want you to develop your listening skills. Now, you can read it and see it, but you want to know how do you listen to a lecture. In this case, I'm trying to make it a story and move it in, but how you listen to it and hear the key elements. Okay, so there were 11 states, and what was the total population? Guess, anything that you remember? What was the total population? There were 11 states comprising the Confederacy.
The total population for those 11 states?
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll keep on with the sentence then. The total white population of the 11 states now comprising the Confederacy is 5 million. And therefore, to fill up the ranks of the proposed army, 600,000. That is typically an army, you think of it about 10% of the population. Okay? About 10% of the population you want to have an army. So they said 600,000, okay, will be required. In any other country than our own, such a draft could not be met. But the southern states can furnish that number of men and still not leave the material interests of the country in a suffering condition. You got that? Now, why do you guess he's suggesting, the author is suggesting, that they can actually meet the quota of having 600,000 men fighting out of this population and still not leave the material interests of the country in a suffering condition?
Because they can use the African soldiers in their army?
Nope, not quite. Use Africans, but not soldiers at this point. Nope. Well, captives, yeah, but what? How? He said, we couldn't do this. We couldn't put 600,000 soldiers on the field, except in our particular condition, we can do that and not have the material interests of the country suffering. His assumption was that Africans would continue to take care of the babies, work the farms, take care of the material interests of the country. Y'all with that? So that was part of their war strategy. And I'm continuing with Du Bois here. The editor, with faith, did not for a moment contemplate any mass movement against this program on the part of the Africans. Quote, those who are incapacitated for bearing arms can oversee the plantations, and the Africans can go on undisturbed in their usual labors. In the North, the case is different. The men who join the army of subjugation are the laborers, the producers, and the factory operatives. Okay, you got that. So in the North, if you're going to join the army, it is not the rich folks that join the army. The laborers, the producers, the factory workers, those are the folks who join the army. So what does that mean for the material interests of the North?
Yes, they would dwindle, and they wouldn't really have any material
interest. Right, which is why one of the reasons that is debt. You know, war is debt. And so so you got that, what they thought was a good thing going, okay? Nearly every man from that section, that is the laborers, producers, factory workers, especially those from the rural districts, leaves some branch of industry to suffer during his absence. The institution of captivity in the South alone enables her to place in the field a force much larger in proportion to her white population than the North, or indeed any country which is dependent entirely on free labor. Now this is the continuing the quote from this article, okay? The institution is a tower of strength in the South, particularly at the present crisis, and our enemies will be likely to find that the moral cancer about which their orators are so fond of prating is really one of the most effective weapons employed against the Union by the South. So they were counting on these Africans who to continue their labor. And it was through that they would have an advantage. And your ancestors, in addition to taking the battlefields like the Battle of New Market Heights and many others, your ancestors also fought as laborers. They said, you will not have that advantage, and snatched that advantage from the South, transferred that advantage to the North, which is why W. Du Bois says that the laborers, African laborers, won the war. In addition to, when you read about the Battle of New Market Heights, sometimes called the Battle of Chaffin Farm, you'll also find that white soldiers, colonels, saying that the battle of that what they learned in war school was the Greek standard of heroism, the Spartans, the Battle of Thermopylae, those were the greatest things that they'd ever heard and was inspired by battle. And they would tell you that the Battle of New Market Heights and what your ancestors did on that battlefield totally outstrips any thing they had ever learned in military history in terms of courage to fight. Because Lincoln, with his racist behind, had believed that the African soldiers were inferior and forced us to fight initially with the caps removed from our guns. So that story that I started with the Battle of Newmarket Heights, where the water turned red with our blood, where we had to rush out and take the sharpshooters, we had to fight them without being able to shoot because they'd taken the caps from our guns. And that's what your ancestors did to make sure that we free today. So the storyline would be the Union saved black people and white people with the Emancipation Proclamation and all that saved Africans. The story is the opposite. Determined to free ourselves, Africans saved the Union. Remember that line. Determined to free ourselves, Africans saved the Union. There would be no United States of America as we know it today if your ancestors hadn't been determined to free us. I don't mean determined to free us to save the Union. We were determined to free ourselves, and in doing so, we saved the Union. That concludes my talking, and it's 10:29. I want you to just give me a few minutes. I'm stopped talking, but I want to give you an opportunity to say anything you want to say as a way for us to close out. Anything you learned that you want to tag. Any feelings you have, any thoughts that you have about this, about what you learned today. The mic is open.
Okay. I appreciate this class and Barbara Jessica for bringing new perspectives that we haven't necessarily covered yet. I appreciate the reading from W.E.B. Du Bois and learning about Christian Fleetwood and having the book The Black Reconstruction of America as a reference.
Thank you, Safia.
I appreciate Bob Bartes for telling us information about what happened and what Africans, what we were determined to free ourselves, and for Bob Bartes coming to teach us about it.
Why, Kanata? Why do you appreciate that?
Because be aware that we were determined to fight, and makes me feel like powerful and just like pretty good and knowing it. And
all right, thank you. Anybody else?
I appreciate Baba Okesa for coming to teach us today, even though because Baba Sean couldn't be here. And I appreciate the reading from the W.E.B. Du Bois and incorporating that into our lesson today. And I appreciate everyone for giving their participation in the text chat and on the mic.
All right, appreciations or learn to relearn going once. Going twice. All right, folks. Have a good break. For those of you going to Mama Fia's class, she'll be waiting for you at the appointed time. I've enjoyed it. Take care.
User left your channel.
Okay, Mama Nisa, if you're here, are you still here?